Chapter 5. Better 5 years late than one day early. I'd made the long drive from Dallas to Los Angeles many times before, but this time I was pulling a 40-foot trailer with a 2-seater helicopter sitting on it. I had about $6,000 to my name and a truck full of dummies, tools, and dreams. I ended up in Redondo Beach, California, where Keith's aunt and uncle, Dave and Billy Bowen, rented me a room for $400 a month. That was a darn good deal even in 1988. I was still signed with William Morris, and Mike Lacy booked me at Comedy and Magic regularly. He was still convinced that I was perfect for The Tonight Show, and even more so now. So I was living in Los Angeles, I had an agent, and the audience laughed at what I did. Having never forgotten Jim McCauley's promise to see me again, I focused my efforts on getting on the show by making my act tighter and funnier. Lacy did some prodding and talked Jim into coming to see me again. I had been doing my 6 minutes everywhere I could, as often as possible, for the past 6 weeks. I knew I was ready. It was now early December of 1988, barely 2.5 months after actually moving to Los Angeles. That's a crazy short amount of time to have been in LA and to potentially be ready for Carson. There was a good reason for that, though. Unlike most comics who moved to LA to seek fame and fortune, I had already been performing for 18 years, and now I'd been working my butt off in LA, specifically honing my act with this one goal in mind. It was a good show with a great audience that night in Hermosa Beach. I nailed it, and McCauley saw it all. He met me in the green room afterward and congratulated me on my improvement. He loved Peanut, the little dummy of me, Jose Jalapeno, and the worm in the bottle. He said I'd done a great job of making it just right for Johnny and the Tonight Show audience, and that he'd call me the next day and give me a date. I still have that old answering machine with the message from his assistant giving me the details. I was on the books for December 30th, a Friday night no less. I was stoked. It was finally going to happen. I almost couldn't believe it. I flew back to Dallas for a week to visit my parents for the holidays. And when I told them I was finally going to be on the Tonight Show, they couldn't have been more excited. They literally told everyone they could, even strangers in line at Luby's. The three of us went to Neiman Marcus in Dallas, and Dad and Mom spent a little over $1,200 on my show outfit, which included an unbelievably nice Armani jacket. That was another important part of being on Carson, unlike the talk shows today. Back then, you dressed really well for the king of late night. I flew back to Los Angeles a couple of days before the show. Jim and I had agreed that the night before, I would run my set at the Comedy and Magic, and Jim would be there to make any last-minute notes. That night, the audience wasn't as good as they had been a few weeks before, but I still did okay. I was a little worried when I went back to the green room and McCauley wasn't there to give me his notes, but Lacy told me not to worry and to go home and get a good night's rest. He said it was going to be great. Taping was the next afternoon at 4 p.m., and I needed to be ready. The next morning, I woke up early, and I was an excited mess. My parents had phoned everyone, and people were calling to say they'd seen my name in TV Guide. At about 9 a.m., when I knew McCauley usually arrived for work, I called his office. His assistant said he couldn't take the call, but he'd get back to me as soon as possible. An hour went by. I tried him again, and after being put on hold for what seemed like an eternity, he finally picked up. "Any notes from last night?" I asked excitedly. The long pause was deafening. He took a deep breath. "Jeff, I made a mistake. You're not ready." "Wait, what did he just say?" I didn't want to hear the next sentence. My hopes and dreams and all that I'd worked for so long were now hanging in midair. "But it's just in a few hours." "What?" I faltered. Jim replied, "I've taken you off the show and I'm looking for another guest. I'm sorry." I will never forget that moment. I'd been on cloud nine. I was within hours of my goal, and now it all started to crumble. It was more than heartbreaking. It was devastating. There was nothing else in my life at that time that was as important as this one career goal and dream. I sat there on the phone, not wanting to hang up, hoping that somehow he was pulling a joke or that he would change his mind. He started talking again. "Look, this doesn't mean you can't ever be on. Right now, you're just not ready." And then he shared with me a piece of wisdom that I didn't want to accept, but I understood fully. He said, "When you do stand-up for Johnny Carson, it's better to be 5 years late than one day early." He encouraged me to keep working, and then he hung up. For a long time, I stood there, staring at the wall in front of me with the dead phone still to my ear. I looked down at my desk and touched my father's electric pencil sharpener that he'd given me from his office a few years before. As I touched it, the knot in my stomach tightened even more. When I moved to Los Angeles and was setting up my desk, I plugged the sharpener into the wall and vowed to never empty the shavings until I had been a guest on The Tonight Show. Not hours before, I had looked at it, knowing I would be emptying it before midnight. I pushed it back a couple of inches. I hung up the phone. I had to call my parents and as many friends back home as I could to let them know the show wasn't going to happen. To drive the knife even further into myself, I couldn't help but watch the broadcast that night. Johnny's monologue was great, the audience was hot, but the person that Macaulay found to take my place was a girl named Mary Christmas. And that was the only reason she was on, because her name was the same as the greeting. Maybe I would have gotten on if I had a dummy named Happy Hanukkah. After New Year's, I did what I'd always done, and that was to keep working. The always passionate and committed Barbara Hubbard had booked me at a few more colleges in the past few years, and along the way I'd picked up an agent for the college circuit. This was a great arena for me, offering more experience and exposure with a younger audience. The money was good, and I was traveling regularly now for the first time. The road isn't exactly easy, but I was slowly learning the tricks of travel when it came to getting through airports quickly, how much to carry on, what to do when flights are canceled, etc. In large towns and small, well-endowed schools and the less fortunate, I was also treated to the gamut of housing and sleeping arrangements. One night it would be an okay hotel or motel, the next night it would be someone's house or in a cold, drafty, unused dorm room. These were nights alone on the road, night after night, town after town. Most of my money in 1989 came from colleges, small comedy clubs, and a few corporate gigs. The clubs were B rooms at best, and they booked me as a middle act. Headlining hadn't happened yet. Most important, though, all these gigs and all these different kinds of places with so many different types of audiences let me simply work on my act. My work ethic was pretty simple. If I was getting laughs, I was doing things right. If the crowd wasn't rocking, then I had to improve or lose whatever wasn't working. Both the college and club audiences were unforgiving and honest. If they liked you, they let you know. If not, for me anyway, they usually wouldn't boo or heckle, but they weren't generous with their response. Dave Dowds, the William Morris agent who signed me when I won the college competition, still tried to open doors for me as best he could. He was a senior agent, but I don't think many of his cohorts thought much of his new client. Think about it. William Morris was one of the biggest, most prestigious talent agencies in the world with clients like Bill Cosby. And now the state fair agent signs the college-aged ventriloquist. Yikes, I don't think Dave was talking anyone at Morris into really taking me seriously. In early 1989, Dowds somehow got me on stage at the Melrose Improv to do a guest spot. I was given 8 minutes to do my thing. Melrose at that time was what I considered a very dark but hip club. All the Hollywood elite would show up, including industry folks and the best of the best comics. It was the hangout, and I was not one of the guys. Most people in the business looked down at me, and I could literally feel the internal groan when I walked on stage at Melrose. I was not hip or slick or cerebral. I was not a New York comic. I was a young guy wearing a tie and holding a dummy. But I got up there that night, and the audience just happened to dig what I did. In the crowd that evening was the ever-watchful Bud Friedman, the man behind all the improv clubs and the TV show A&E's An Evening at the Improv. That night, Bud walked up to me, stuck out his hand, and said, "Hi, Bud Friedman. Congratulations, kid. You got the show." "Thank you very much, and nice to meet you," I said. I had no idea just how important Bud could be to me, nor did I know what a good relationship with him could do for a comic. I'd done so many of these guest spots around town for various clubs with Dave dragging me here, there, and everywhere that I didn't really know the significance of our handshake. I didn't even realize that evening was an audition for television, but that night was the beginning of a long and very important relationship. Bud Friedman and the improv comedy clubs were the chain to be in good with if you wanted consistent employment across the country. Just about every comedian wanted to be a regular in the improv chain, but it was a difficult fraternity to be invited into. Anyone who wasn't a pure monologist wasn't considered a real comic. If you used any kind of prop, it was a crutch. So I was handicapped as a variety act. Guys felt like you were relying on something other than your wits and spoken words to get laughs. There were plenty of comics on the road who, without ever seeing my act, had concluded that ventriloquism was a tired and sad old vaudevillian art, pigeonholed in the same class as plate spinning and mime. My apologies to plate spinners and mimes. And that an act like mine could never be as hip or edgy as pure stand-up. Rarely did anyone have the balls to say anything directly to me, but throughout my 18 years of working the club circuit, I found personal insults about my characters and me more than once on comedy club green room walls.
Should we tell him?
Probably.
See?
We did it!
What?
He didn't understand. Let's move on.
There were a couple of club owners and bookers who were as disdainful as some of the comics. While on the road one weekend doing college gigs, my agent set up an audition for me at Catch a Rising Star in the Big Apple. The Catch clubs weren't quite as prestigious or important as the Improvs, but were a good stepping stone. Longtime friend and fellow ventriloquist Al Gettler accompanied me to the club that night. We got there early in the evening, long before the show started, so I could talk to the club manager and find out when I was to go on. This was a showcase night, which meant comic after comic would go on, each doing a fairly short bit. When we found the club manager, I introduced myself and reminded him that Dave had arranged the gig. He greeted me with a disagreeable smirk. Then, in a voice dripping with condescension, he said,
"Oh, yes. Let me think. You're something I don't like."
This was a first for me. I had no idea what he was talking about. Did he mean a Texan? Baylor graduate? Protestant? Then, of course, it hit me. "I'm a ventriloquist," I said.
"Oh, yes," he replied nastily. "Well, you'll be on at about 10 o'clock.
"Okay," I said. "How long will I have?"
6 minutes. "You'll get the light."
Nice. That was fine. Al and I waited. The show started at 8, so 2 hours passed. Then two more. Now it was midnight. Comic after comic kept going up, and another would be introduced. I found the manager again and asked him where I was on the list.
"Don't worry, you'll get on," he grinned.
It was now after 1 a.m. Al had a wife and two little girls at home, and plus I knew a "fuck you" when it was in the air. "Ready to go?" I asked Al. "Hell yes," he said. "You're better than this." I always try to not let the ego get in the way of a good business decision, but this was no way to treat anyone, no matter what. We left, and Al and I have laughed about that guy ever since. Whenever I see Al, I say,
"You're something I don't like."
"I think we found the title to your next book."
"Gee, thanks."
"I wonder where that club manager is today."
"I'm not sure."
"Probably still booking clubs. Read this and weep, loser."
"Stop it."
"Okay. Loser!"
For every negative experience, there have been a bunch more good ones along the way. At least that's how I remember it. As cool as it was to meet Bud Friedman and to get the booking on A&E's An Evening at the Improv, more important was the small flurry of phone calls it caused in the next couple of days. Bud didn't book the talent in all the improvs around the country, but soon he would want me to audition for the woman who did. Eventually, I would be introduced to Deborah Sartell, the Jim McCauley of the improv chain. If Deborah liked you, you had a load of work ahead of you. But you had to prove yourself first. You had to go to comedy boot camp. Welcome to the nightmare gig in Las Vegas. Not all improvs and comedy clubs are made equal. There are the A rooms and the B rooms and the, well, shitholes. I'm not going to say the 1990s Vegas room was an exact shithole, but it certainly made you realize really quickly if you had what it took to be a road comic. Inside the Riviera Hotel and Casino was the Vegas Improv. It's where a comic got his or her chops. It's where you had to prove yourself. The crowds were tough, the guy who ran the room was a tyrant, you had to pay for your own drinks, and meals were with the hotel staff in the employee cafeteria.
Mmm, casino food!
There was no ego allowed in this paradise. Unlike other clubs around the country that usually had one show a night every day except Friday and Saturday, when there was two, this joint had the comics doing 3 shows a night, 7 days a week. That was 21 shows a week. 21! I still have a copy of my first check from Bud for those 21 shows. I made a total of $850 before taxes and commissions. The first week I was there, I was the middle act, and the headliner was Bill Engvall. I got along great with Bill and knew him from Texas. He even gave me a suggestion for Walter, and that was simply to use the word dirtbag as a punchline because it was such a Walter word. "What do you do for a living?"
"I write greeting cards."
"Oh, could you give us some examples?"
"All right. How about a get well card?"
"How does that go?"
"Sorry to hear you're sick, dirtbag."
"Anything a little kinder?"
"Belated birthday. Sorry I missed your birthday. I thought you were dead."
"Do you have anything that's a little more romantic?"
"For someone you love?"
"That would be good."
"I love you as sunshine over oceans. I love you as moonlight over mountains. They say love is forever. I love you, dirtbag."
Another guy at that club was a big Goomba by the name of Steve Sharippa. Besides being the director of entertainment at the Riviera, on a nightly basis, Steve ran all three small showrooms located just off the main casino at the top of the escalators. There was the Improv, La Cage, and Crazy Girls. Each room sat about 200 people at best, and they all had self-serve bars in the back. Nice. Steve would bark orders and intimidate employees left and right, and everyone jumped when he growled. Of formidable size and truly fitting the part, Steve was the epitome of a connected guy. Oh, and that's probably how you'd recognize him today. He was Bobby Bacala on The Sopranos. Now a celeb, back then Steve was just the scary guy that you knew who would break your legs if you did something wrong, or at least that's what most everyone thought. My first night at the Riviera, I met Steve in the showroom at the appointed time to set up. He gave me my little talk, which concluded with, sure enough, a threat to do me bodily harm if I went over my time. I told him no problem, but I wasn't quite sure there wasn't a little acting in his performance. For the first few nights, I stayed within my allotted time for the most part, and maybe went 30 seconds over. I think I had to do something like 15 minutes total. But on the Thursday night, it was an awesome crowd, and I went 2 minutes over my time. Steve was in the back of the room, shining and blinking the flashlight in my eyes. At 3 minutes over time, I rapped. By the time I reached the self-serve bar at the back of the room, Sharippa was in my face with his own mug and a big, fat, ringed finger.
Do you know what fucking time it is? Do you know how fucking far you went over? If you ever, and I mean fucking ever, do that again, I will personally break your fucking legs. Capiche?
I stood there looking at him with a frown, not breaking eye contact. I'd seen other guys almost wet their pants at his dressing down, but the drama just seemed a little cartoony to me. I had a feeling Steve was actually a good guy. It just seemed a little over the top, so I took my chances, and in my best New York Italian mobster accent, I said, "Yeah, I hear ya. You're gonna break my fucking legs." He stood there for a few seconds glaring at me. I then made a big, exaggerated grin, eyebrows raised, eyes wide open, and showing all my teeth. He was a good 5 inches taller than me, so he was looking down. I saw his jaw twitch, then he started to chew on the inside of his mouth. He was either going to smash my face in, or... He broke into a big laugh, slapped me on the back, and said, "Yeah, you're all right, kid. Just try and stay within your time." I've run into Steve now and then since, and he truly is a good guy. Just don't fuck with him. The Vegas Improv was, of course, the least glamorous of all the improv clubs. The comics didn't even get a room at the Riviera. We had to stay at the most horrible of horrible dive motels on the Strip, which was right next door to the Riviera. Peanut's joke was,
"They remodeled our motel. They put new duct tape on the carpets."
1 week while working Vegas, all three comics had our separate rooms broken into on the same night. It was obviously an inside job by someone who knew when we would be at the Riviera working. I had just purchased some really nice portable Bose speakers and a Sony CD Walkman. Remember those? They were all gone after the show. I remember another time being woken up in the middle of the night, jolted out of my sleep. I'd made it to the door, hand on the latch, turning the knob, almost bursting into the hallway to assail the attacker, before I realized that the woman's screams weren't from terror, but from, well, pleasure. The sound through the wall wasn't even the slightest bit muffled. Playing the road like this really wasn't any kind of glamorous life. It was grueling, it was lonely, and at times sleazy. But if nothing else, after having lived a very nice upper-middle-class life back in Dallas and in Waco, it was a true motivator. I wanted to move up in the world. With the exception of the Vegas Improv, while working almost all other clubs, the headliners got preferential treatment and much better accommodations than the lower acts. I shudder when I hear the words comedy condo. This is where the opener and middle, also called the feature, acts would stay. A club would purchase or rent a condo or apartment, usually within walking distance of the club, and that's where you'd live for a week. Talk about sleazy. Road comics come from all walks of life, usually younger guys and a few chicks, who were happy just to have a gig and a roof at night. You never knew who was sleeping in the bed the week before you, or what went on there before you arrived. It was much worse than even a sleazy motel because there usually wasn't a maid service. To further cut costs, the clubs usually made one of the lower-ranked managers or even a server head over on Monday mornings to tidy up. Sometimes you'd arrive on a Tuesday, and the well-worn sheets would still be in the washer or dryer. Lord knows what stains those were on the carpets.
I'll tell you what was on the carpet.
Please don't.
At the comedy condo, I was too happy to be sleeping in a trunk.
The final straw came in Minneapolis one winter when I was playing a club called Dave Wood's Rib Tickler.
Dave was a stand-up who I met working at the Comedy and Magic a few times, and he was part owner of this downtown Minnesota club. I'd never experienced truly cold temperatures, but this would be the week. Negative 40 degrees with a wind chill of negative 70. Holy mother. Southern Californians and Texans are not hardy folk when it comes to temperatures like that. But the cold wasn't the point. I got dropped off by the cab at the condo, and the front desk guard gave me my key. Oh, let me mention the cab. I'd heard this rumor before, but I had to confirm it. When the cab driver picked me up at the airport, I asked him when the last time was that he'd turned off his engine. 2.5 weeks. Because of the cold, some of these guys would never turn the car off. They just let it idle, even when they were inside asleep for the night. Block heaters did no good at those temperatures, according to this guy. It was better for the engine just to keep chugging. It was too damn cold. Anyway, I got to the condo and opened the door. It was like a bad movie. Stains on the walls, floors and ceiling, discarded food containers scattered about, holes punched in the drywall, and a kitchen and bathroom that looked like something out of a bad CSI episode. But the final straw for me were the 2 or 3 crusty stains on the bedspread. I was disgusted, and I'd had it. I also knew the only way out was to become a headliner in the A-clubs.
Or get a real job!
After getting good reports back from the Vegas Improv, Bud finally set up a time for Deborah Sartell to check me out. I was scheduled to do 20 minutes at the short-lived Sherman Oaks Improv, which was an ingloriously converted banquet room located inside the Marriott Hotel at the 101 and 405 Freeway Exchange. But unlike the jaded industry Hollywood folks from the Melrose Club, this was certainly more my kind of crowd. This was a more typical audience for me and not the jaded industry Hollywood folks. Afterward, one of the lower agents from Morris introduced me to Deborah. "That was great," she said. "I'll start booking you right away as a middle." Whoa, perfect. It was so simple a statement, yet such a huge career moment. The agent was almost as shocked as I was happy. Trust me on this. Next to no one expected a vent to be able to work the improvs. And Deborah was sticking her neck out to the club owners simply by booking me. But the proof had been the reaction by the crowd in front of Bud, as well as in the reports from the Vegas Club. So now, the real road work began. There's nothing easier for a good comedian than being the middle act at a comedy club. There's very little pressure because no one is expecting you to be good. You don't have the responsibility of carrying the show. You just have to get up there, do your thing for 20 or so minutes, then get off. It's a layup. Well, I was just too darn competitive to be content with a layup. I knew I could headline. I sharpened my 20 minutes to a fine edge, and it was becoming a very powerful set. This was still 1989, and in addition to the Funny Bones and some other independent clubs, I started doing multiple weeks nationwide at Bud's other improvs, courtesy of Deborah Sartell. In addition to Melrose, the improvs that existed back then were Dallas and Addison, Texas, Seattle, Washington, D.C., Cleveland, Tempe, Arizona, Brea, California, Irvine, and San Diego. Shows were always Tuesday through Sunday nights, 8 or 9 shows a week. A couple of other names you might have heard of who were also middle acts at that time were David Spade and some guy named Adam Sandler. And pay? The three of us were getting top dollar for middles back then, $100 per show. So I was pulling in $700 a week. I was probably working 42 weeks a year, so that's about $30,000 a year. After one really strong week at the San Diego Improv, I called Deborah and I said, I was wondering about headlining. She replied, "You what?" And I said, "Well, I really feel like there are people in the audience that are there just to see me." I could almost feel her roll her eyes over the phone. "Don't tell me you think you're getting a following," she said. "Well, yeah, I really think I am." She took a deep breath and spoke a sentence that became the perfect challenge. "You can move up from middle when the headliners can no longer follow you." I replied, "Okay, deal."
"This is my favorite part."
"What is?"
"This is where I kick ass and take no prisoners and women fall at my feet."
"That's a little much."
"I can dial it back."
The tipping point happened soon after at the Tempe Improv, not too many weeks after that. In 1989, jalapeno peppers weren't exactly a popular food for most of the country, but in the Southwest, and especially Arizona, Jose Jalapeno's Honestik got a huge reaction. Then I topped his segment with the tequila worm in the bottle bit. I ended with the 5-voice fast-talking business. It was a killer set. It was made even bigger by the fact that no audience was expecting much more than average stand-up from the middle guy. Oftentimes, I'd get standing ovations, and that's pretty rare for the middle guy. The best part?
According to folks on the inside, I was making the headliners uncomfortable because I was tough to follow. I was soon given a trial run as headliner at the, guess where, the Dallas Improv. That was my hometown, and I guess the powers that be wanted to give me the best chance at doing well.
I was so excited, senor.
You? How'd you show it? By opening your eyes slightly wider?
Peanut.
What?
The next big step was appearing on television in stand-up comedy shows as often as possible. It was 1989, and the then-fledgling Fox Network was having success with a show called Comic Strip Live. I performed on that show multiple times, as well as on more of A&E's An Evening at the Improv. Next was Jonathan Winters and his traveling road show on Showtime, and a few others here and there. For each television appearance, I had to pare a portion of the act down to a tight 5 or 6 minutes. I began to figure out by watching the stopwatch what would make a killer television comedy segment. The guys who did well in these stand-up shows, or on Carson or Letterman, did best if they got a good laugh within the first 20 seconds. And then, there was simple math. If the guy got a laugh every 6 to 12 seconds, the spot was killer. So that's 5 to 10 laughs per minute. Conversely, if he or she was getting 4 laughs or less per minute, it simply didn't go well. Also, the television audience is a different animal than the club audience. Usually they want the comic to do well, but they immediately start to get nervous if the comic is sweating or if the laughs aren't there. At that point, they begin to get quiet, and it can all go south very quickly. With each and every television appearance, The Tonight Show never left my mind. Between 1986 and the spring of 1990, I auditioned for Jim McCauley a total of 8 times, and after each one, he turned me down. My 10-year high school reunion was scheduled for June of 1990, and I didn't feel any closer to achieving my goal than I had 5 years before. No matter how many shows I did on TV, or how many sold-out shows and standing ovations I got at clubs and colleges around the country, I wasn't happy with where I was. That elusive Carson goal was always seemingly just one audition away. For as long as I could remember, my father had told me he wanted to go to Africa on a safari. He had grown up watching Johnny Weissmuller in Tarzan movies, and he had always dreamed of seeing the wilds of that continent. He was now 63 years old, and he had finally made plans to go over there with a tour group on a 2-week picture safari. My mother never wanted to go. She was delicate and fearful and knew she couldn't handle it. Dad was chomping at the bit. "Who you going with, Pop?" I asked. "No one," he said. "Dad, that's sad," I replied. "I don't mind," he said. "It'll be fun." I sat there thinking. I felt really nervous about leaving the country because I would be out of touch and with no one to answer the call if I got a big gig. But I also knew Dad wasn't getting any younger. He'd talked about this since I was a boy. "I'll go, Pop," I said. "What? Really? Are you sure?" he asked. "Sure," I said. "It'll be fun." "That's great!" We left a few weeks later, and it was a once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Not only did we see every wild animal he'd ever talked about, but we took literally hundreds of pictures. We missed Mom, as neither one of us had never gone that long without talking to her. To this day, I've never told Mom the secret of how much beer Dad drank that trip. I didn't even know he liked beer. Way to go, Pop! Not long after we returned from Africa, my 9th audition for Jim McCauley and The Tonight Show took place. It was late March of 1990 at the Ice House in Pasadena, California. It was just a guest spot, so afterward, I was out in the parking lot putting the big trunk back into my car while the show was still going on. I was alone. The Morris agents had long since given up going with me or even scheduling these auditions. For the past few, it had simply been Lacey telling Jim to see me again at the Comedy of Magic or me calling McCauley at NBC and asking nicely. I was a little depressed as I hefted the heavy case into the vehicle. The audience had responded well, but I didn't feel the 6 minutes was all that much different from the other 8 times. I'd changed a few jokes here and there, updated characters, and tightened up the laughs a bit, but basically, it was the same stuff. I didn't know how to make it any better without starting from scratch. Jim walked out the club door and toward my car. I was ready for the same old, "Really good, but you're still not ready." "Well, you got it," he stated with a smile. "Got what?" I honestly didn't know what he meant. "The show. You got the show. I'll call you tomorrow and we'll find a date." My mouth hung open and I just stood there, blinking, not really comprehending what had just happened to me. Then his words took on meaning and an honest-to-goodness joy swept over and through me. I look back now and have to smile at what an innocent and simple time that was in my life. Completely self-absorbed in my own career with zero responsibilities other than to make sure I called my parents a couple of times a week just to say hi. That was it.
I gave a little to charity here and there, rent was low, my health was good, no one was depending on me for anything, and my mom prayed for me every day. There was no war, no threat of terror, and the economy was good. All I had to do was get on stage every night and make sure that everyone who had paid good money for the show laughed a lot. And now, a goal that I had set 9 years and 10 months before was about to finally be achieved, only 2 months before its due date. I asked Jim later what the difference was that night, and he said it was confidence, timing, and better jokes. Well, that all made sense. I had practiced that bit over and over so many times that it had become second nature. But would it pay off when the real pressure was on? Even though I'd done the bit a million times before, I rehearsed it over and over in front of the mirror and video camera in my tiny room for the next few days. No fat, no unneeded pauses. Like I've said for many years, ventriloquism is easy. Comedy is hard. Though I felt like it might be bordering on bad luck, I told all family and friends again. Mom and Dad once again called everyone they could think of. This time I bought myself a designer silk suit for something like $1,000. You could be on Carson for your first time only once.
A silk suit?
That was the fashion at the time.
What, looking like a white pimp?
As a kid, my favorite fast food restaurant, hands down, was Burger King. I decided that my LLBC, last lunch before Carson, had to be a Whopper with cheese, no pickles, fries, and a chocolate shake. I had timed things just right so that I arrived at NBC in Burbank only a few minutes before I was supposed to. Once again, it was just me. No agent, no manager, no publicist, no family, and no girlfriend, which was okay since I didn't want any distractions anyway. One of the guards told me where to drive and park, and it was unbelievably surreal. All the parking spots next to the main backstage entrance had nameplates on them clearly visible. There was a Corvette, spotless and beautiful. The name read Johnny Carson. Holy crap. I walked up the ramp and into the building. Huge painted images of Bob Hope, Johnny, and a few more of the historical NBC celebrities adorned the two-story walls. I was pointed to a hallway and led to my own dressing room. On the door was a blue card with the Tonight Show logo plus my name printed on it. It was almost too cool to take in. This was the Super Bowl for stand-up comics. I can only imagine what a football player feels like the first time he makes it to that big game. No matter what kind of preparation you've had, no matter how good you are, no matter how confident you are, it's still a big deal. The eyes of millions will be on you, and though most late-night shows are all taped and shown a few hours later, they're still very much live, just like that football game. There is pressure, excitement, nerves, and energy. Johnny Carson was the true American nightlight. A huge chunk of America watched Carson every night. Freddie DeCordova was Johnny's longtime executive producer, and he met me on stage for rehearsal to talk about what was going to happen in a couple of hours. He said I didn't have to run through my set line by line, but they at least wanted to see my setup and be shown the order of the act. I went through everything with Peanut and the little guys. Then Freddie called me over to the desk to chat a bit. This was the desk and the couch. What countless stars had crossed this stage and sat right here talking to Johnny? I felt like I was on hallowed ground. Freddie said, Jim tells me you have another dummy in your act that's pretty funny. Yes, sir, I replied. Walter. He's a cranky old guy. Well, Freddie said, the odds of you getting to the couch on your first shot are pretty slim. But just in case Johnny feels like having you over, you should be ready. Could you use Walter for that? Gulp. What the... Almost never, and I mean almost never, did a stand-up get called to the couch his first or even second time doing stand-up on Carson. You had to earn that call. Only on your third or fourth shot was it even thought about. Johnny had to really like you as a stand-up for you to have the honor of having any kind of one-on-one discussion with him. On your first few times, you'd do your set in front of the curtain, then hopefully get the okay finger circle sign from Johnny from 30 feet away. Then the curtain would be pulled apart just so, and you'd exit the way you came. I had never even considered actually talking on air to Mr. Carson. Well, yeah, I have a few jokes that would work. I think Johnny would like Walter, I said. Perfect, replied Freddie. Then you can preset Walter right here behind the couch and then reach over if Johnny wants to talk to him? Yes, sir, I stammered. He can sit on his own on the floor right there behind the couch. Well, that was never going to happen, but of course with a live show, they had to be ready for anything. There are times in all our lives when sometimes things just seem to fall into place, and other times when shit happens and there's no explanation. I look back on this first Carson appearance, and I know I couldn't have asked for a better setup. Friday night was the night in the Carson era. It always seemed to be his favorite night, and the audience was always a little more up. Well, here I was, booked on Friday, April 6, 1990. Not only that, but the host was Carson, and the guests were none other than B.B. King and Bob Hope. How the hell did that fall into place? When Doc Severinsen and the band started up, I felt like I was in the car of a roller coaster, strapped in, heading up to the top with no way to stop or get out. This was it. I was in my dressing room watching it on a monitor. Next was Ed McMahon, and here's Johnny! The crowd went nuts, and out the man walked himself. I hadn't met him or talked to him. I still hadn't seen him in person in the hallway or anywhere. But in a few minutes, he would be introducing me. I watched and listened. The audience was awesome. Johnny did his monologue talking about Michael Jackson, President Bush, the first one, Dan Quayle, Milli Vanilli, and the 16th anniversary of Twinkies. After the first commercial break, he and the Mighty Carson Art Players did a sketch about a funeral home. Then Hope was the first guest, and he was lucid and charming and funny. Johnny and the crowd loved him. Next, B.B. King came out and did his thing. Same result. During his number, I was called backstage to take my position behind the main curtain. Even as I type this now, I can recall that feeling and those nerves so many years ago. The audience was great, and I had done this bit so many times that I knew it would kill. But none of that took away from the feeling of reaching the top peak of that roller coaster. The clacking of the wheels was about to end, and there would be a moment of silence, then a suspension of gravity, and I would soon be on the ride of my life. And that's exactly what happened. The band played during the commercials. As the cameras came back live, Johnny waved the band to quiet. I couldn't see anything backstage in the darkness, just the outlines of the stagehands on either side of me, ready to pull back the curtain and let me walk through. There was no monitor, and Johnny's voice was muffled, but I knew he was introducing me with a few credits. I held Peanut in my arms, right hand up his back and into his head, his body perched on my left hand. My case and other props with Jose inside were preset at the star marker on the floor center stage. I knew when Johnny said my name in Peanuts, the curtain would part and out I would walk. No cancellation hours before. No more questioning whether I was ready. Doc and the band hit it. The open curtain sent a blast of TV lights into my eyes, and my feet were carrying me to the spot. The audience applause was deafening, but the band was even louder. This was a drug. This was unlike anything I had ever experienced. The laughs were in all the right places, and the performance couldn't have gone better. I look back at that tape now, and I smile a little bit because so much has changed in my style and comedy and performing abilities. But at that moment in time in my life and in my career, I couldn't have done any better. I did the final drinking of the cranberry juice tequila Chianti while Peanut said, "Going, going, gone," and the crowd went bananas. Doc and the band hit it again. I took my bow and I couldn't have been happier. I had done it. I had finally done it, barely 2 months before my 10-year high school reunion. And to top it all off, I looked to my right and there was Johnny across the stage, giving me the all-important crowning OK sign with his thumb and index finger. My insides did a leap, and I smiled and waved back. As I was taking another quick bow, I looked to the right of center camera, just a few feet in front of me, and there was the floor director making a signal for me that my brain took a few seconds to understand. He was waving me not to go back through the curtain, but to go to the couch. If I watch that tape, it's only for a split second, but I can see the horror in my own eyes in that instant. What was he telling me to do? This had never been in my imagination. I had not planned on this, nor even considered what I would possibly do on the couch next to Johnny Carson. My feet started to move in that direction, and it was one of the longest walks of my life. The crowd was hip and recognized the moment for what it was. They went even more nuts. How was it possible that Ed McMahon and B.B. King were now standing up and moving over for me? Bob Hope had come and gone. Now was truly the test of the metal. I got through a couple of questions about myself and my helicopter, and then Johnny asked me about Walter. This was truly unbelievable. I reached around the couch and pulled out the character who would turn out to be Johnny's favorite of all my little guys. Walter was all attitude. "How are you, Walter?"
"Who the hell cares?"
"You know where we are?"
"Yeah, and I don't give a damn."
"But this is Johnny Carson." I pointed to Johnny and Walter looked.
"Well, la-dee-da."
We did a few jokes about the show and Johnny. It was simple but effective. Johnny, BB, and Ed all laughed, as did the crowd. But the best was yet to come. This was toward the end of the broadcast and after the last commercial break when Johnny always thanked his guests. I was last.
"Jeff, good to see you. Hope you come back with us.
Walter, I hope you're in a little better frame of mind next time.
That'd be a cold day in hell if I ever come back.
It might not sound too amazing today, but this wasn't any talk show host. This was Johnny Carson, revered and respected, and Walter had just dissed him. I had that line in my mind as we were coming back from commercial, but I knew I was taking a big chance with it. Johnny was king, and I was just a road comic. But all had gone well that night, and I figured I'd gamble. Johnny laughed hard, Ed and BB cracked up, and it worked. As the show ended, I shook hands with Johnny, and he was gone. Would I ever make it back? Would I ever have an actual conversation with Johnny Carson off the air? As I walked backstage carrying Walter, one of the agents from William Morris greeted me. He had shown up unbeknownst to me during the taping. He was one of the older guys and had been in the business a long time. You know, your life is never going to be the same, kid. Remember that. I knew he was right. It could never be the same. But what was next? After shaking a few hands backstage and thanking as many folks as I could, I walked out of NBC at about 5:30 p.m. It was 8:30 on the East Coast, and the show would air there in 3 hours. I thought this was the end of a perfect day. I was wrong. At that moment, reality was heading toward me at about 80 miles per hour down the 405 freeway. I never saw it coming.